We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another Adult Improver edition of Perpetual Chess. This week, we are joined by a return guest, friend of the pod. He was on episode 201. He is the founder and executive director of the Charlotte Chess Center and Scholastic Academy. And in our first interview, our guest, Peter Giannatos, he's contributed so much to chess. He's been a scholastic teacher, a chess player, and he's built just an amazing chess club that we went in depth on in our prior interview, how he built it from the ground up. So anyone particularly interested in, say, business or how to create and build a thriving chess club and community should definitely listen to Peter's interview. And we talked about his adult improver exploits in that interview for about 10 minutes. But this time we're going to go deeper because Peter has some rare accomplishments in the sort of field of adult improvement. In his 20s, while he was building this incredible chess business, he took his USCF rating from about 2100 to 2390, which is around where it sits to this day. That's a level where a lot of chess players start to plateau or at least get stuck. That's certainly where I got hung up, so I'm eager to pick Peter's brain. And he hasn't been playing as many tournaments, of course, with the combination of the pandemic and running so many events at the Charlotte Chess Center. But he's still an avid Blitz player. And Peter tells me that his Blitz ratings on both chess.com and Elite Chess are hitting new highs in the 2600s. So I'm eager to hear all about his progress. And then later in the interview, of course, we've got some other stuff to catch up on with Peter. He, in addition to being a Twitch streamer for the Charlotte Chess Center, is out with a new chess book called Everyone's First Chess Workbook. It's also available as a course on Chessable. It's an excellent primer. Peter, of course, has a scholastic chess teaching background, so he knows what people need to build from the ground up in their chess. So we'll be discussing the vision behind that book. I've checked it out, and it's excellent. And last but not least, we'll be talking about what's new with the Charlotte Chess Center. Specifically, there's been a bit of controversy lately about how Grandmaster titles are won, and Peter is a great person to sort of give his perspective on that. So with the long-winded introduction done, let's get him back in here. Peter, welcome back. How are you?
Great, Ben. Thank you for having me back. And I was eagerly awaiting this interview to catch up a little bit on the chess instruction and improvement side of things. So I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, excellent. And regular listeners hopefully know, first of all, you should listen to the whole interview. But if you're only interested in certain topics, we always have timestamps in the show notes. We're going to go deep on adult improvement, and then we're going to get into these other topics. But Peter, I always find him insightful and entertaining. So let's get to it. So Peter, we took to Twitter yesterday to get a few questions for you. And often I don't like to go too deep into the background of someone's chess, like their beginnings, because, you know, which family relative of theirs taught them chess to me is not necessarily the most interesting part of someone's chess career. But JJ Lang, friend of the show, been on the show as an accomplished adult improver in his own right. And I believe he cut his teeth in North Carolina. He at least went to the University of North Carolina. So I think you guys have some shared history. And JJ went even further back than the rating gains that we mentioned, and sort of mentioned that you had kind of like a steep ascent early in your chess development. So JJ went and looked at your tournament history and then said, so you went from 1015 to 1588 in a 12-month span leading up to the tournament where you drew a 1900 in round one and gained 100 points. So he was just mentioning that you had, even before these later gains, just impressive results. So could you tell us a little bit about like your entry to chess and how quickly you were improving in those, I believe it was your teenage years?
Sure. So yeah, JJ was went to high school in North Carolina. So I remember playing scholastic tournaments with him. I don't remember if JJ and I ever played a rated game against each other, but yeah, so I remember playing a few of his teammates and spoiling their, I mean, that's how I caught his attention, I'm sure. But yeah, so I started in as a 13-year-old, and I was not a diamond in the rough. I wasn't one, you know, somebody that was playing at home or anything like that. My first rating was 500, but as you noted very quickly, basically just, I mean, hit all the rating, you know, sort of the rating barriers that people face, with plateau at actually 1600. And I know that a lot of your viewers probably, I mean, can relate to something like that, getting stuck around 1500, 1600, 1700. For me, it was 1600. And I was stuck there for about a year and a half. And then it was just like, I gained right after that, like 300 rating points in like a year or something. So it was an incredible sort of, it was incredibly frustrating at that time, because I felt like I was just stuck at the 1600 rating level for about a year and a half. So yeah, I'd like to discuss that. But as far as what I did to go from 1000 to 1500, I would say that at that time, it was mostly playing and analyzing games, analyzing my own games with a coach. At that time, it was Matthew Noble, who I referred to in the first podcast, and he was coming to my school at that time. So I'd play rated game, and then I'd come and analyze the games with him. And then at home, I was going through game collections, and that was a big way that I improved at that rating level, because it helped me understand what the best players do, where they place their pieces, and kind of how they think about the game. Even between the rating of 1000 and 1500, I attribute game review, either my own games or the games of others, you know, the great players, as a way that helped me improve between 1000 and 1500. Now, I should say I went from 500 to 2000 in about 3.5 years. So the whole journey was, it seems quick, but it didn't seem quick to me at that time.
Yeah. And a couple things, of course, these things tend to happen a lot more commonly when you're either a kid or a teenager, that sort of gain. But I think that the lessons that you learned in terms of like grinding through a plateau, like it can still be applicable, even though you might have had a bit more neuroplasticity than myself and a lot of our listeners might. Now, let me ask you something, Peter, about the studying of games. And as we mentioned in our first interview, your Twitch channel is highly educational. You know your chess history cold. You know all the old school secret Soviet guys, and do a great job breaking down the games. But I've heard a lot of people, I've heard a lot of people say when they go through Master Games that the problem is, despite the annotations, even a well-annotated book, they don't understand a high percentage of the moves. And I think especially now, as you know, engines take an even greater primacy than probably during your climb, even though it wasn't like super long ago, I think now people are a little spoiled. So when they see a move they don't understand, they just it bothers them. They don't know how to approach it. So what was your approach and what advice do you have for that sort of conundrum, Peter?
Well, at that time, my approach was just to work through it because I didn't know better. I wasn't a chess coach and I didn't really have perspective on improvement. I just wanted to do chess, and I was picking up what I could from every game that I looked at. It wasn't like a lot of your adult improvers, they seem to have these very sort of strict regimens about how they approach things. For me at that time, it was like, I would review a game and then take what I could from it. Now, as a chess teacher, as a chess coach, and somebody that has perspective looking back, I would say that the lower your rating, the further back in chess history you should go when you're analyzing your games, when you're analyzing famous games. Because I feel like it's much easier to understand the games of, let's say, Paul Morphy or Steinitz for a 1200 rated player or 1500 rated player than it would be to analyze a modern game of Carlsen or Anand or basically any of the modern, you know, the modern world champions. And I think one of the reasons for that is the disparity in strength of players at those times. You're able to see the ideas carried out kind of clearly. Whereas in modern games, the players are so good that they know all the basic ideas. So it really takes, you know, they're really squeezing, water from a stone in most of their games. And so for the lower your rating, the less you appreciate or can understand the more microscopic things in a chess position. So I would say that looking back at it, if I was advising the, you know, Peter of then, say like, okay, look at the games of Paul Morphy, go back in history, look at the games of Paul Morphy, look at the games of Steinitz, look at the early masters to begin with. Their games are a little bit easier to understand because of the disparity in strength of players and the knowledge gap between the players. So that would be my recommendation. At that time, it wasn't like I was saying, oh, I don't understand this, let me plug it into the computer, or I don't understand this, let me take it to somebody and have them explain it to me. I just understood what I could and then moved on, based on my ability at that time.
Yeah, that's good advice. And I agree with what you say about starting with the classics. I've mentioned on the show a few times and interviewed I.M. Willie Hendricks, his book on the origin of good moves. Kind of, that's the sort of the overriding thesis of the book is that if you trace the history of chess, you trace the development of ideas. So if you're newer to chess, it's great to start with the old games. I know that Neil Bruce is a big fan of First Book of Morphy, which I'm not familiar with, but if you're looking to study Morphy, obviously, some book about him, or even just downloading his games from chessgames.com and just kind of slowly going through them. Or if you're a video learner, just look up Agadmatur's series or whatever it may be. But let's bring it forward, Peter, because then you got to sort of where the rubber meets the road for a lot of people, what you've done in the past 10 years. And of course, in your 20s, I mean, some people manage to maintain their interest in competitive chess throughout their lives. But it's also a time when a lot of people who are scholastic players, competitive chess can go to the back burner. Even for someone like you who makes their living from chess, the actual competing side can be a challenge. So before we get to the improvement, I want to hop into the next Twitter question. And this one is from a longtime friend of the pod, Peter Newhall. And Peter has been echoing something that I've been seeing people talk about more recently in sort of the chess discourse. Shout out to Avtek Gregorian of chessmood.com. Does like intro calls with the new students, he always says to start with the why. And Grandmaster Noel Studer wrote a great post about how important it is to know what your motivation is for improving. So Peter asked you, Peter, what was your motivation, especially in your 20s? Why did you decide to keep going? And a little perspective on like how hard you were working on your game during that period might be helpful.
Yeah. So for me, it was a personal achievement. type of situation. So I started late. You know, I mean, for somebody who is who later became a master, I definitely started late in life. You know, as a 13.
Started 13, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And when I graduated high school, I had hit 2000 at some point, but then I had dropped below. So I was about 1950 or so whenever I went to college. And I took a year off. I mean, of any serious kind. I think I still played at the club, at the local club during that time in the weekly rated games. But I didn't play any weekenders or any serious events. I kind of was taking a break. And my good friend, who also became a master, Dominique Myers, kind of drugged me out of, let's say, mini retirement and said, you know, like, come back and play the North Carolina Open with me, and come, you know, like, we'll go up to Greensboro together and we'll play the North Carolina Open. And so that renewed my interest in the game. And I think I beat a master in the second round, I think, as like a totally retired, like, I mean, not really caring about my game. And I wasn't playing online blitz or anything like that. It wasn't as popular as it is now. And I was like, you know, maybe I, you know, sold myself short. So I kind of renewed my interest in the game. And I said, you know, I should do this for me. I should really try to become a master if possible. And yeah, it was a personal achievement. And it was also, you know, I'm always motivated by, you know, people telling me like I can't do something or that it's mm-hmm. kind of not possible to do something. So it was also a little bit of a motivation to say like, okay, yeah, I started late, and most people who do start late don't become masters or whatever, but you know, I'm going to show them that I can actually do that. But it was more, you know, it was more for me, but it was a little bit to, you know, to just kind of prove to people that it was kind of possible. You know, I was motivated by competition. One of the reasons why I don't play anymore is I don't play classical chess for enjoyment. I play to win.
Yeah.
And if I'm not studying the game, I don't have any expectations that I'm going to go into a tournament and do well. Why should I? You know, why should I believe that I'm aging like fine wine just sitting around doing business things or listening to, listening to podcasts unrelated to chess? You know, the reason I don't compete is like, I'm not going to go be everyone's punching bag.
Yeah. I learned that lesson the hard way. That's what I did in my 20s and 30s is I wasn't a competitive chess player, but I would show up once in a while. And it's not like riding a bike really, but go on. Sorry.
Yeah, not at all. And I, you know, because of my competitive nature, I don't want to play in a classical tournament if I'm not working on my game, because I am a competitor at heart. So if I just want to get my fix playing chess, then I can do that locally at the chess club, you know, playing casual games, blitz games with my friends, you know, who are similar in strength. You know, Naroditsky's here, so I love playing odds chess with him. And then I can play online for additional practice. But one thing I think we'll talk about a little bit later is, you know, you have to work on your game to improve. I mean, it's such a simple statement, right? Like, you have to work on your game to improve. And we'll talk a little bit about how exactly that is. But at this present time, I'm not playing in tournaments because I'm not really working on my game. You know, online blitz is not really working on your game. And I know that was one of the questions on Twitter as well, which was how much online blitz helps. So we can get into that. But yeah, so basically, I'm not really working on my game right now, which is why I'm not playing classical chess. And yeah, you have to just regularly do chess. And we can talk about, I guess, the specifics.
Yeah, let's hear what you did.
So at that time, as you know, right out of college, I made master the same year I started the chess center and the same year I graduated college. All of that happened in the same time. So in college, I basically went from 1950 to 2200 USCF, something like that. And so it took quite a bit of time. And one of the best things that happened to me during that time was I worked with coach Alexander Shabalov. That was who I was working with at that time. And Ben Feingold, who had worked for the Chess Center for a few quarters when he had a sort of off season in St. Louis. That's when he was in St. Louis. He had not yet started the Chess Center in Atlanta with his wife, Karen. He was here in Charlotte. And those are the two best things that happened to my game, because I learned so much from them that was not really, let's say, there wasn't a strict lesson, let's say, that I learned from. You know how, like, you read a book and you read a chapter and it's, let's say it's on hanging pawns or it's on isolated pawns or whatever. And you feel like you can, oh my God, okay. So, you know, that I have an increased knowledge of that topic because I just read this chapter out of the book, right? It wasn't that type of knowledge that I was learning from Shabalov and Feingold. They were really helping me with how to think about the game, how to think like a stronger player. And that's something that, at least in literature, I had not really come across something as powerful as simply working with the strong players that I was working with. And so during that time frame, I attribute a lot of my growth to analyzing games and positions with Shabalov and Feingold. And I know that a lot of your guests, I think I was listening. I mean, you just published the Marcos video today,
yeah.
But I was listening to it a little bit in the morning, and he kind of talks about, you know, how to think like a better player is such an important element of the game. And I only really ever learned that, Ben, from working with these great players, you know, and they were both great coaches as well. And Feingold, particularly for kind of the psychological aspects of chess. I'll give you a kind of one of the stories. Cause you know,
awesome.
Everyone sees Feingold as this like big goofy, like GM who's like on Twitch all day. And I kind of see him that way too, but he's a friend of mine. And so I see him as a personal friend, and I'll also see him as a chess coach. He had served, you know, many times on like the world youth chess team that we would send, you know, to represent the US, and he's a great coach. So I remember, he was covering for me at the Chess Center, and I was going to go play in Reykjavik, Iceland, the Reykjavik Open. And before I left, he said, "Here's what's going to happen, Peter. You're going to beat somebody that you are not used to beating. Okay. So you're going to upset somebody big." Okay. And I was about 2150, FIDE at the time. He said, "You're going to upset somebody. And here's what you're not going to do when that happens." I mean, this is all hypothetical, right? He's like, "Here's what you're not going to do when that happens. You're not going to call me excited. You're not going to type on Facebook how you just defeated a strong player that you normally don't defeat. You're going to beat them and you're going to act like that's normal. And when you upset this player, whoever it happens to be, you're going to pretend it's just another day in the neighborhood." Okay. And no book was ever going to tell me that. And, you know, and that's more of the psychological aspect of the game. And so I did. I beat an international master. I think it was for the first time ever. I had defeated an IM in a classical game. And I didn't call Ben because he was following the tournament. He was following the tournament online. So I didn't even call him. I was like, I want to call him. I was just like, this is like a celebration, you know, like I this is amazing, right? And I wanted to call him, but I didn't call him and I didn't type him. I didn't text him or anything like that. He just said, "Listen, you need to treat defeating better players like it's going to happen regularly." And I would say that, you know, that fits into the kind of confidence. I know one of the questions on Twitter, I don't remember exactly, is like, how much do I attribute to psychological aspects of the game?
Yeah, Jim Jones, yeah.
Yeah, you have to have skill. But the psychological aspects of competition, any competition, chess or otherwise, are super important. And Grandmaster Ben Feingold had helped me with that a lot. It wasn't just that circumstance, but I wanted to share that story because I still remember it vividly and it stuck with me. Like, okay, you're going to beat somebody. And later on my path to FIDE Master, I had defeated GMs over the board, right, in classical games. And I didn't throw parties for myself in the evening or send group messages to my friends with the game, showing it off. I was just like, this is going to be a regular thing for me. You know what I mean? And that, and, yeah. and that's what Ben Feingold, that's what Grandmaster Feingold taught me. And that was such a big deal for me. So I hope that touches on a little bit of the psychological aspects of the game. And when you're competing against illustrious opponents, it's hard to believe you have a chance if you've never faced them before, right? If you've never faced IMs and GMs over the board and you're like a master, you're used to playing experts and regional masters, you know, where you live. And then all of a sudden you're playing what I would consider professional players, IMs and GMs. It's like, you're like starstruck. You're like, oh my gosh, actually the person who I defeated has multiple books and that type of thing. So I already knew who they were. It wasn't like random European IM. And so the psychological aspects of the game, believing that you can actually win, and even though you know somebody's better than you, such a big deal. And treating an upset victory not like it's a once in a lifetime experience, but that it's going to be a regular occurrence. I think that's a huge piece of advice related to psychology, which I directly learned from Grandmaster Feingold.
Awesome story. Shout out to Ben. Yeah, I think it was Herschel Walker who said, this is an NFL, former NFL player, when you get to the end zone, act like you've been there before. Some former NFL running back. But anyway, Peter, maybe we could sort of broaden that, because obviously not everyone has access to legends like, they do actually have access to Ben Feingold, along with the 1,000 people watching or whatever thousands it may be at a given time, or Grandmaster Alexander Shabalov. So how would you apply that to, say, like a 1,400 hungry adult player where, okay, they could hop in on a Grandmaster's Twitch stream and some of them might only have 50 viewers, so maybe you can pick their brains, but would it be just as helpful for a 1,400 to be hanging out with, say, 1,800s, or does it need to be like strong titled players if you're looking to sort of absorb the culture and the way that stronger players think?
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's all relative to your strength, right? So if you're 1,400 and you're able to place yourself around a group of 1,800s, right, you will become a better player by being around people who are better than you. I don't know how much an 1,800, let's say, could advise on chess psychology and some of the deeper points in the game that take a long time to kind of learn. But certainly you would become a better player by learning chess from them. Because I should say that while psychology is a very important part of the game, it isn't the most important. The most important is skill. And if you're a 1,400 and you can surround yourself with 1,800s, great. You will learn the skill part from them. I mean, to sort of bridge the gap between 1,400 and 1,800. I mean, in this hypothetical that we're talking about. So yes, I also greatly learned by being around people who were better than me. And what I would do is I'd pay attention, right? How this is, Ben. I mean, you lose enough games to somebody, whether it's a blitz game or whether it's classical games, you lose enough games, you kind of wake up and you start to notice things. Why am I getting whipped every time by this guy who's 200 or 300 points higher rated than me? How is that possible that I'm not getting a single game off this? And then so all of a sudden, whether you want to believe it or not, you start paying attention. What are they doing better than me? Oh, I'm always losing out of the opening. Oh, I'm getting tricked with tactics, right? So one of the things, my advice, other than placing yourself around stronger players, which is a great piece of advice, be alert, try to discover how they approach the game, how they think about the game. I think that's relevant for all rating levels, whatever your rating level is. But I would say that one of the things I see with adult improvement is just that not all adults have the desire to step out of their comfort zone or do something new. And sometimes too much information is a bad thing. So when it comes to adults, because a child isn't going to listen to, let's say, your adult improver podcast or read Twitter forums, or I just recently discovered this so-called chess punks hashtag on.
You got asked about that.
Why am I not a part of this? So yeah. I just recently clicked through some of their stuff, and it seems like a group of adults that are eager about about learning the game better and improving and that type of thing. But over the last decade, I've coached a lot of adults, and we have a lot of adult members coming into the club. And I would say that sometimes too much information, because adults understand and interpret information better, right? Like than a child. You start talking chess psychology and chess improvement with children, it's like, like, just let me go play. But when an adult wants to improve, they're like, oh, you know, I listened to this podcast and so-and-so said they read that book, or, you know, I need to do 30 minutes of this every day and then 15 minutes of that every day. And, you know, it's like, oh, Neil Bruce cut his you know, diagrams out of the book with red scissors. So I'm going to go to Family Dollar and get some red scissors. You know what I mean? So sometimes too much information can be misleading. It's like for adults, one of the things I've noticed from the outside is the, what I call the learner's mentality. I'm sure it has a real name, but I call it the learner's mentality. And I feel like the older you get, including for myself, the older you get, the less willing you are to step outside of your comfort zone, accept criticism, and learn a new way of doing things. And so an adult may be told by a higher rated coach, let's say, I think you need to play something other than the London system, right? Because that's super popular with adult players, right? I think you need to play something other than the London system because I want you to learn different pawn structures, let's say, right? So that's what, let's say, a higher rated coach may tell a 14, 15. But they go, well, I don't have a lot of time because I'm working. And say, okay, so the fact that you don't have time and the fact that you're an adult, what, gives you a pass on chess improvement? Like you're supposed to improve because you don't have time and because you're unwilling to change? Like, how does that work? Why does being an adult, why does that, you know, exempt you from the hard work that everyone else has to put in, you know, to learn the game better, right? So we can talk about various ways that I changed my game into my 20s to be able to maintain my chess skill and not lose it. But when you're talking about growth, you have to be willing to step outside of your comfort zone and try and learn new things. I feel like adult players, again, including myself, I'm throwing myself into this category. The older I get, the less desire I have to change what I'm doing in anything, the less desire. But, you know, if we're trying to say, okay, an adult wants to improve just like a child improves rapidly, then we kind of have to follow a similar path. We have to be willing to step outside of our comfort zone. And the fact that you don't have enough time because of life, that life gets in the way, what does that mean? You know, because like, it's like you don't have time, but yet you want to, let's say, improve at a rapid pace. But why? Right? So like, what exempts you from the amount of time, let's say, a 13-year-old puts into the game and then gains 200 rating points, right? So I would just say that one of the things I've noticed with adults is, not all adults, but I'm just saying, like, one of the things I believe that sets back adults is, you know, like I said, the unwillingness to try something new, to step outside of your comfort zone, and not always being willing to accept critique of the things that they're doing. And that may be a bitter pill to swallow for a lot of people that are watching. They might say, I'm not one of those person. You know, I'm not one of those people. And then I analyze their game and I say, like, why did you do this? And they're like, you know, because that made me happy, or that made me comfortable. And I'm like, yeah, but don't do that. And they're like, well, I felt safe. Yeah, that's what I felt like doing. I'm like, okay, right? So I would say keep your mind open to learning. And when you choose a coach, right? So if, like, let's say Ben, I'm like, okay, Ben, I want you to teach me, right? So
bad choice.
Right. But I want you to teach me. And then you're like telling me to do something, right? I have to respect you enough to say, I picked you as my coach and I trust you. You know, I trust you that you're going to help me. And I'm going to listen to you. And even though I'm an adult, and even though I have a life, and even though I have all this, I'm going to listen to what you have to say. right? And I'm going to be willing to change and adapt, even if that means my rating might fall 50 to 100 points while I'm adapting. I'll give you a story related to that. When I started working with Shaba, I was about 2,100, and I had the hacker repertoire that you like you couldn't even imagine. Okay, everything was a gambit. Okay, and I was, you know, I was already 2,100. So he's like, so I'm playing Evan's gambit. I'm playing, you know, the white side of the two knights defense. You know, like with d4. I'm playing Mora gambits. I'm playing just all sorts of stuff. I'm playing the Benko gambit every game. I'm playing the Alakine and Perk defenses again. You know, I'm just playing hacker chess. Okay. And Shaba's like, Peter, enough of this. This is coffee house chess. Okay. You want to be a master, you got to play real chess. And I'm like, what's that? Like, I don't know. I was kind of teaching myself. I'm like, what's that? And he's like, well, you got to play classical chess. You got to put your pawns in the middle. I was like, pawns in the middle. I was like, I've never done that before. You know what I mean? I was like, I've never played a defense where I have a pawn in the middle of the board. I always played the provocative defenses, right? So what happened? Well, he started making me play the French with black just to have some center control, but not have, let's say, the amount of theory, let's say E4, E5 has, or the Sicilian. And then he, you know, I started playing classically against D4, Queen's Gambit Decline. And I went down a little bit during that time. I got stuck in the 2100s for, I can't even count, maybe 3 years. But, oh, by the way, with white, he made me play the Roy Lopez, which I believe was the most boring opening ever, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, what's happened? Where is my checkmate? Okay. So, I started playing the Tirage French, and just very, let's say, professional openings, you know, things that real people play. Okay. And I got stuck while I'm trying to learn this new way of playing, you know, for about, but, you know, I trusted Shapovalov, right? I'm like, this is the guy I picked for my coach. He's a grandmaster, several time US champion, Soviet trained, literally trained by Mikhail Tal.
Yeah. I'm amazing. Like, Latvian legend. Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm like, I have to, if I want to improve, and I was in my 20s at that time, right? Because I made master when I was 23. USCF master when I was 23. I was in my 20s. I'm like, this sucks. Like, I'm totally out of my comfort zone here. I'm playing things I don't fully understand, but I trust Shaba, you know? And so I did that. And then when I made master, it was like, boom. I gained, you know, little by little, it seemed like every tournament I was playing in, I was gaining 20, 30 points at a time, right? Once I finally, so my plateaus were 1600, and 2100. Those were the plateaus in my life. 2100 was because I had a massive change in the way I was approaching the game. I had never played in that way. But then once I overcame that, it was like, boom, it gave me another 200 rating points when I started playing what Shaba called real chess, you know? And if I was stubborn and didn't want to change, get out of my comfort zone, I felt like 70 rating points, it hurt. You know, I was like, I was questioning, like, is this really what I should be doing? But I understood the game better by trying these more standard openings with more rich pawn structures and positions. And it helped me improve in the long run. As you know, man, the process for improvement takes time. So when I look back at it, I can't say that just these few things, right, are what helped me become a better player at that time. I just know that they were in very important moments in my chess improvement, right? I was still analyzing games. I was still doing tactical puzzles like Volokitin's Perfect Your Chess. You know, I remember doing that when I was about 2100. But these were the things that changed me as a player. These are the things that took me outside of my comfort zone, right? And my advice to adults is be willing to do that, even if that means your rating graph isn't just a line up. You know what I mean? Because when you change something and when you get outside of your comfort zone, you're not just going to understand it. You know, you're going to feel like a fish out of water whenever that happens. And your results will also reflect that. And it might be discouraging, but it could be what you need to make the next jump, you know, just from whatever plateau you're at, you know, at the moment. Because a lot of people get stuck and they're like, what should I do? And I'm like, change something. I don't know what it is because everyone's reasons are different, but change something, right? And that's uncomfortable for anyone, but it's a necessary part of improvement.
Awesome advice, Peter. It really resonates with me personally. And I've been so transfixed, I forgot to take a break and hear from our sponsors. I want to do a bit more on adult improvement, Peter, but first let's take a quick break. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. If you haven't checked out aimchess.com by now, what are you waiting for? What aimchess does is it collects your games from the major chess sites and then gives you actionable advice of how to improve your game. It might be to work on a specific opening or to get better at end games or improve your time management or whatever it may be. And then it gives you related puzzles to help you improve that specific skill. They are constantly improving the site. They recently added blindfold tactics, time management training, common checkmate patterns. So there's so much to do there. If you decide to subscribe, be sure to use the promo code PERPETUAL30. Details are in the show notes for aimchess.com. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by chessmood.com. Chessmood is a subscription video service by a team of GMs headed by Grandmaster Avchek Grigorian, who you can hear on episode 192 of Perpetual Chess. They offer a comprehensive video library featuring an opening repertoire for both colors, as well as courses on middle game and end game mastery. They also have great free content. Avtech has an insightful blog, and they have a YouTube channel featuring daily lessons with a grandmaster. So all the links you need if you want to find out more are in the show description, or just go to chessmood.com and have a look around if you're interested.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
And we are back. So, Peter, this has been amazing perspective. I think it might be a wake-up call for some people, or at least inspiring, if nothing else. I certainly feel that way because I've been switching my opening repertoire. And my results, you know, I don't know the structure is cold yet. And it's been a learning curve for sure. But one thing I wonder about, Peter, just to sort of tie it together, is especially at this 2100 plateau, the more recent plateau, you mentioned in our prior interview and in this one, Volokitin's Perfect Your Chess, which is a great advanced, we should say, tactics book that I mentioned on the last interview is out of print, but I think it is available in Kindle possibly. But more importantly, Peter, the question of time that you've alluded to many times, like how much time, I mean, you've got a life where you're sort of immersed in chess, obviously, but how much time were you actually grinding? How much time were you studying during this period of breaking through the plateau and ascending to a near 2400 USCF rating?
Yeah, well, that's hard to know because even though I was in chess, the vast majority of my day was spent doing business related things, you know, operations style things. So that actually can take away a little bit from your desire to do chess for yourself, right? So when you're around chess all the time, giving lectures, teaching classes, directing tournaments, whatever it is, sometimes when you have free time, you don't want to do chess. So I'm not sure if that, you know, if being around chess, let's say, helped me. It certainly wasn't like I was sitting at the chess center reading books and studying all day instead of running a business. I was running a business, and when I had time, I was studying the game and I was playing the game. So I would say probably on average between 2100 and, you know, 2390, I was probably spending an hour a day.
Okay, that's not
at
crazy.
That time.
And how often were you competing?
Not I wasn't competing that much because that was to me a huge time commitment, and I couldn't always break away and go somewhere. So I was playing, I would say, one big event, like a large open event, you know, let's say five or more rounds over a weekend, maybe once a quarter. You know, when I could get away on a holiday weekend or something like that. And when I was taking lessons from Shaba, that was 2100 to about 2250. We would meet for 1 2-hour lesson a week. So that's how we did. So most people, you know, just kind of have a 1 hour lesson. Shaba was like, no, we need a 2 hour lesson. And it wasn't like he was just, it wasn't like he was trying to get money out of me or whatever. He's very reasonable. It was just that he thought that if we could work on chess for 2 hours, that I would be more encapsulated. Like I would be kind of like immersed in the chess that we were looking at, not like, oh, we just got started talking about something or analyzing the games. And then before we know it, the hour's up. So he thought a 2 hour lesson was more beneficial. And I agreed. And what I would try to do for him is I would try to have games for him to review. And as a coach, well, as a kind of former coach, I don't really coach anymore, but as a coach, one of the things that I always recommend to students is if you're going to hire a coach, have specific things you want to talk about. And in a, and the most specific thing that you could possibly talk about with a coach is your own games. And otherwise, you know, having a coach for a lot of people can actually be a waste if they're not playing, if they're not actually playing. Because what you really need, aside from the generic lessons that you could read or learn through videos, is you need a deep critique of your own games. And so yeah, so that's what I was doing. So I had an hour a day where I was studying various things, you know, openings, and I didn't really study that many endgames, I have to be honest to with you. I would love to say that I did and that I, you know, that would make me a complete player or something. But like I tell people, I only have Devretsky's endgame manual to look cool when my chess friends come right, over. Yeah. I never actually read any of it. So, and that's the truth. I spent a lot of game, a lot of time on my opening play, and I never really played, you know, too hardcore theory, but I tried to keep up my opening so that I would feel comfortable going into a tournament. Like, hey, you know, I've studied, I'm not going to be surprised, I'll be fine. And the Volokitin book I solved over a summer with my friend, National Master Dominique Myers. And what we would do is, so because as you mentioned, the puzzles are hard. I mean, as a 2100 player, I would say, and we were both 2100 at that time, I would say that we only solved about 65% of the puzzles correctly. And what we would do is we'd meet up at like a coffee shop and we'd set the clock for 10 minutes, like a chess clock. And when the 10 minutes expired, we would tell each other what we thought the answer was. Okay. And then we would look. And in many cases, one of us was right, or we were both right, of course, but in many of the cases we were both wrong. And that was a wake up call for me. I'm like, dang, like I need to improve at this. And Volokitin's book, and I should say that it probably doesn't have to be Volokitin's book, right? So the fact that I refer to it is just because I did it, right? It's not to say that any other similar book, like Romain Edouard's book on calculation or Jacob Agard's book on calculation, which are great as well. I mean, I flipped through them. I haven't solved all of the puzzles in them. In Volokitin's book, I solved all of them. So it could be another book, but I would say that that was what I needed at that level to be able to calculate like a master. I was not visualizing and calculating like a master yet.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, so you did the hard work. And again, similar to what you were saying earlier about like switch things up. And I've mentioned many times that's where I struggle to this day, is doing the, you know, eliminate the distractions, like, you know, get out the chess set and do the, you know, improvement happens at the edge of your comfort zone, as you say. Yes. Now I will say I'm not improving, or at least, you know, it could be revamping the opening repertoire or whatever, but I also like, I don't blame, I'm not shocked that I'm not improving is what I'm trying to say. Like, I understand that it might not happen with the approach I have. And I think that's fine for a lot of people listening. I mean, we talk a lot about doing what you enjoy. So it's also okay to study some, and maybe you'll get better, maybe you won't. But if you're doing what you enjoy, it's kind of a win-win. But as Peter says, if you're really dedicated and you really want to improve, and then and what you're doing isn't working, then try something different. So Peter, one more improvement topic, because we still got the other non-chess improvement stuff that I want to pick your brain about. But let's hear a bit about the Blitz, since you mentioned you're at least semi-retired from competitive chess, but you're still pushing new highs. So how do you new Blitz highs? So how do you adapt your game for Blitz, Peter?
Yeah. So one thing I should say about improvement before we move on is. You know, I remember being in a car once with like a friend, and we were going to play tennis, and he's not really like a chess player. And I was maybe early college, and he's like a doctor. And I was like, well, we're smarter now than we were before, right? Like that, those were the exact words I chose. Like, we're smarter now. He said, Peter, I'm not sure if we're smarter now, but we're more knowledgeable. Okay. So we understand things better, but I'm not sure that we're smart, right? And when I think about chess improvement, I'm always becoming more knowledgeable of the game. I know more than I've ever known. But I have to say this before we move on: the chess is both strategy, which tends to rely a lot on knowledge, and calculation, which is the moves which you choose to carry out your game, whether it's the strategic part or the game finishing part. And the hardest part for me is training calculation, because that requires me to run on all cores, right? So if I'm solving something as difficult as Volokitin stuff, or endgame studies, which I know are designed to trick me and are beautiful in nature and that will take me 10 to 15 minutes to solve, I just don't do it, Ben. And I don't want to speak for you.
That's me, you know, too, yeah.
But you don't do it either, right? Yeah. And so when I look at it and I go, the reason I'm not motivated to go compete is I'm like, listen, one thing I know for sure, when I analyze with a 2000, I see 80 times more than they do. When I analyze with a 2500, they see 80 times more than I do, or whatever. I'm making up the number, right? But they see significantly more than I do. And then you start wondering to yourself, you know, all these books that people are reading about strategy and everything like that, that's knowledge. That's general knowledge. This is how you approach an IQP, an isolated queen pawn. This is how you approach hanging pawns. This is how you approach this end game. But wait a minute. That's knowledge. So even if I know that at the board, if I'm making mistake after mistake, small mistake, large blunder, doesn't really matter. If I'm not visualizing the board clearly, then I'm not saying it's all for nothing, but you're limiting your growth. So that's why when people say, do your tactics, you know, that's what everyone tells you. Everyone's like, yeah, but
right.
What about all these books that are on my list for reading? Or somebody posts on Twitter, oh, look at my book collection, right? And it's like Simple Chess by Michael Steen, which, by the way, I like that book. How to Reassess Your Chess by Jeremy Silman. Love the book. Great book. All these great books. My System by Nimzowitz. Don't let Yasser on you. My System by Nimzowitz or whatever. Hey, guess what? Fantastic books. Great books on strategy. But the reason why you, Ben, are not improving, the reason why I'm not excelling, is that I need to be able to see the board as well as an IM. Mm-hmm. I need to be able to see the board as well as a GM if I want to be able to compete with them on a closer to even level. Yes, in a single game, I could win. Okay, and I have won. But if I want to get to that level, that would be the next level for me, trying to score IM norms and get to that level. Every phase of my game would have to improve, but the hardest one to improve, because I could go memorize some opening lines. Like, I'm not a dummy. I could use several different sources to do that, Chessable or my databases, Chessbase or Lee Chess, and prepare those, write notes to help me remember why moves are played. Yeah, I can do that. But at the end of the day, you're going to get to a position in your game where calculation is required. I don't care if it's opening prep. I don't care anything like that. Unless you're beating somebody out of the opening with a forced line, which isn't going to happen at a 2400 level, then, you know, at some point you're going to reach a game where you have to think clearly and calculate well. And the stronger the player, the better they are at that phase of the game. So before we move on, I would just say, like, I have to say that knowledge, fundamental knowledge, strategy is important. And being able to say, okay, I've got this outpost here. I'm gonna get my piece to the outpost. Okay, and so you did that, right? So you got to the outpost and then you blundered all of your pieces away. Or you got to the outpost and you let them undermine the outpost, or you let them bounce back from their strategically terrible position because you could not see what their ideas were. You could not carry out the moves necessary to nurse your advantage, right? So knowledge, I have. I've analyzed 8 million gazillion games. You couldn't show me a strategic idea where I would be like, wow, that's so amazing, because I've seen that all. But guess what? That doesn't make me an IM. That doesn't make me a GM, because I make too many mistakes. Maybe not egregious blunders, but I make too many small mistakes. So even when I have an advantage, I can't freaking keep it. You know what I mean? They're playing tenaciously. They're putting me every move. I got to be accurate. You see at the top level, Ben, like, they're one little thing and it goes from like potentially winning game to a draw. And we have the ability to monitor computers while they're playing these games, right? So I would just say the reason why you and I, Ben, are not improving, and I'm not going to speak for everyone else, but I think that if people are honest with themselves, this is probably where they fit in. The reason why you and I are not improving is we're not doing those Vola-Keaton drills and endgame studies that take us 10 to 15 minutes to actually work out. We're not doing those that actually stretch our brain, make us better players, allow us to visualize the board better. We're not doing it. And that's the hard work. It's uncomfortable work. And it's one thing to play for fun. I play for fun, but I do that at home. If I'm going to play in a competitive tournament, I got to know that I'm in the chess gym, and the chess gym is no pain, no gain. So that means if I'm like, oh, la, 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 look at this great chessable course, or this new in chess book on Fabiana Caruana's Roy Lopez. Oh man, I feel like a genius now. And then I go to a tournament. I haven't been working on my calculation. I get some plus over equals position in the opening, and then I screw it up against a higher rated player because they're better at me than in every phase, right? So it's great to do what you like to do, Ben. And I know that hits close to home with adults, right? Have fun, enjoy doing it. And that is part of the learning process. But you do reach a certain level where it's not just about knowledge. It's about your ability to perform, your ability to make actual moves, right? Like the actual moves, not some general point like, oh, I have the isolated pawn, I blockaded the pawn, but to actually make moves, right? And that's where you and I are not improving. And that's why our ratings are not going up.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's 100% true for me. It's nice of you to put yourself in the same category. I mean, for you, it's kind of like, to me, it sounds a little like you've taken your foot off the gas because you did some work that I haven't done.
Right.
But Peter, we're both a bit higher rated than most of the people who will be listening to this. So let's sort of last thing on the improvement topic, just because I think this is gold for people. Let's bring it down to say like under 1600, like, because there is lower hanging fruit the lower you go in terms of improving. So yes. What would be the applicable lesson for a listener who says, okay, you know, Peter's making some great points, but they're not going to study Vola-Keaton. Like,
no.
What do they need to study that maybe they're putting off? I mean, one thing that comes to mind from my perspective is I often recommend step two thinking ahead, which does like blindfold training. Mm-hmm. And I know there are improvers out there grinding that stuff, but books like that train visualization, all the blindfold tools on LeeChess and chess.com. But Peter, what comes to mind for you?
I never did blindfold, and even to this day, I'm still terrible at blindfold chess. And I know that a lot of instructors recommend it, but I wonder how much of it they actually did. I think a lot of people recommend it, and they kind of, in theory, it sounds like a great way to help you visualize, but I wonder how much they actually did. For me, it's solving at your, not at your level, because you don't want something where it's too easy, like you figure it out in like a minute. I would say whatever your level is, solving puzzles, you know, calculation drills, solving puzzles, which take you between 5 and 10 minutes to solve, I think is the sweet spot for improvement, because you're not, you know, going over 10 minutes to me is not very practical, because even if you were in a game situation, you don't want to be spending like 30 minutes trying to come up with a move. So I feel like you have to be practical, and you don't want to be discouraged. It's kind of like, if you can solve puzzles, if let's say you find a book where you can solve the puzzles, 70% of the puzzles in 5 to 10 minutes, but you're not solving them faster. I mean, maybe once in a blue moon, you solve one quickly, but that the vast majority of them take you 5 to 10 minutes, and then you still don't get them fully correct all the time. I think that's the perfect way to improve for even a lower rated player, because what that is doing is it's pushing you to look beyond the surface, like to the next kind of level. And, you know, that's why when you asked me about Blitz, despite the fact that I reached Blitz peaks now, I don't think I'm a better classical player because of that. Blitz requires different skills than classical chess. I don't think it's bad for your game, by the way. I don't think Blitz, for example, is bad for your game. But to kind of touch on the tactical part, it's like, when I'm in a blitz game, what am I calculating? I am calculating swift 2 to 3 move, quick tactics, making sure that I'm not blundering anything. And yet I still do, of course. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to do that quickly. That's not classical chess. Classical chess is very deep, right? So it's like what works for you in blitz will not work for you all the time in classical play. So that would be the same as like, when you're studying tactics, you do something like Puzzle Rush, or you do something online where the average puzzle takes you 1 to 2 minutes. You know how I've heard your podcast. You know, people are like, oh yeah, oh man, I don't want to call out this book. Okay, do a flurry of tactics, okay, as fast as you possibly can, so that way, and over again, so that way you can just drill it into your head. For me, it's like, no, learn how to think, learn how to approach a tactical situation that is unique and that one that is a struggle, where like in a real chess game, you're analyzing all the possibilities that you never analyzed before, that you never knew existed. I feel like in order to replicate that, you have to pick puzzles that you cannot solve quickly, that you have to think deeply about, right, in all sorts of ways. Because think about it this way. I don't know about you or your viewers, but or your listeners, that when I study an opening, then I get to the board and I'm like, what if they do that? What if they do that?
Yeah.
Like, I don't remember looking at that. What if they do that? And that's because when you're casually studying, right, or you're doing 30-second tactics or 1-minute tactics, right, you're not forcing yourself to look at it that way. When you're clicking through your opening lines, whether it's on Chessable or flipping through a book, and you're just quickly going through the lines, like E4, and you're trying to memorize, then you get to the board and you just go to yourself, well, what if they do that? And what if they do that? And like, maybe there's an answer, but you never even considered it.
Yeah, right? I also forgot about the feeling. I just played one tournament and now I got to retire again because of the Delta variant bomb. But the feeling of not being sure if you're in book. Like, I forgot that was a thing. Like, you're like, right, I think this is the line, but I'm not sure. And you don't experience, you don't care when you're playing Blitz online, you know? So
it's not relevant. And then, so unless you can, and even outside of Blitz, like tactical study, right? Like, it feels good to solve a puzzle quickly, right? But I'm not sure how much that helps you improve. It's like, I feel like the sweet spot is 5 to 10 minutes to solve something. And for every person's level, what that content is going to be totally different. One of the books I like for the middle range player, the intermediate player, let's say 1400 to even up to 2000. It's kind of it's a book that has varying difficulty. Is Forcing Chess Moves by Charles Hertan.
That's reasonably challenging. That's a good book, though.
Yeah, and forcing moves, of course, are the things that you really should, you know, learn and first make sure that you can at least calculate lines of play that are inherently kind of forced in nature. So I really like that book. It is, like you said, that's why I say it's like, I would say 1400 to 2000. It varies in difficulty. Certainly, if you were a 1600 rated player, for example, those would take you, if you got the answer right, those would take you 5 to 10 minutes. So I do believe that is, I have to say this before we get off, like I never did a tactics book until I was 2100. I never did. And no one's ever going to believe that. I never did a tactics server. I didn't do a tactics server and I should have. It's not like I'm recommending people don't. I should have. But I learned through playing games, and I learned through analyzing games. And then when I did Volokitin, that is what I needed, because I had never forced myself to do that. That is precisely what I needed. At a lower level, I think the same is equally good. It's like if you're 1200, pick something that that really pushes you to the limit. It's uncomfortable though, because you're like, you sit there after one puzzle of doing it for 10 minutes by yourself in your living room, and you're like, oh, it would be so much more fun for me to just watch some opening video by like Simon Williams or whatever. You know what I mean? But the struggle is what helps you improve, those sort of difficult puzzles that you can still solve.
Okay. Amazing stuff. So many insights. I hope people are inspired. And yeah, as I said earlier, I mean, it can be a bit of a wake up call. And for me, I mean, a lot of the advice I think Peter's giving is especially applicable to someone around my level. And it's a bit, you know, not shocking, but sobering. Like you just have to do the work at some point. If you want different results than you've been getting. Again, not that you have to, you can just enjoy chess as well. There's absolutely, that's a great way to live. So Peter, I think we're going to wrap up the adult improvement episode and we're going to get on to your other topics. But first, let's take a break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, is known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which utilizes spaced repetition to quiz you and make sure that you remember whatever tactical patterns or opening sequences that you're working on. They have a huge catalog of great books from top flight authors, both for purchase. And if you check for their short and sweet courses, you can find tons of free content. Speaking of free content, Chessable, of course, has also recently launched an adult improvement focused chess podcast called How to Chess, with yours truly hosting it. Check for it on Chessable's YouTube channel. And you can also subscribe on the podcast platforms.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we are back, and secretly it's 2 days later than when we recorded the prior segment, but we are going to keep it rolling. And our plan is Peter is just going to do some bullet points of all the fantastic improvement advice he has given. And then we're going to move on to a couple chess related matters, talk about his book and GM norm chasing, and then wrap things up. So Peter, how are you? And are you ready to go through a few highlights of all this excellent advice that you've dispensed?
Definitely. Happy to be back for the second leg of our interview. And like, as we discussed, you know, I love telling stories and the most memorable stories of my kind of chess journey. But I know that a lot of your audience is also kind of looking for, I don't know, kind of a bullet point or kind of more specific things on what they can do to improve their game. So I was hoping to kind of summarize those here today. And then, yeah, we can talk a little bit about my book and certainly the GM and IM Norm Invitational tournaments that we hold here at the Chess Center.
Sounds good. Yeah, people do love the listicles. So let's get to it, Peter. I mean, of course, I could try it on my own, having enjoyed the conversation and been taking mental notes. But I'd like to hear what you think the most important things are.
Sure. So I kind of have three things that I think are important. And I know that a lot of people say these, so I'll try to elaborate a little bit more on what I mean. So number one is play stronger players. And a lot of people say that. And I think I can kind of define why it's important to play stronger players. And I would just basically, by the way, and that doesn't necessarily mean in classical only. That could mean in rapid. That could also mean in blitz. But just playing people that are better than you. One thing that allows you to, it's kind of an awakening. It allows you to understand what is actually possible and what isn't if you're playing, you know, if you're playing a better player. And then you're kind of able to fine tune your own game once you recognize that. So for example, when I play against my 1300 rated students, they, you know, just go immediately for an attack. And they're like, let's say, trying to checkmate me. And it works 0 times out of 100, right? Because it's simply too brash. Like the what they choose to do may work against their peers, but it doesn't work against someone better than them. And that happens at all levels. So you just need to kind of know, like, hey, what I'm doing now that's working against, let's say, my closely rated foes, like whatever, if I'm a 1400, what works against 1400s may not work against 1600s. And after, you know, after some experience playing players better than you, you'll start to adapt your game and realize, hey, I've got to lift my game up. What works against the lower rated opposition does not work against the higher rated opposition. So, and that is, Ben, that applies at all levels. I think there's not a single time in my chess journey where I don't believe that that was useful, you know, playing better players. And so I always played, I went to tournaments and you know how this is. If you're right at that 2200, line, let's say you're like between 2200 USCF and 2400 USCF, it's hard to play in the open sections these big tournaments because, well, one, there are no prizes for you, basically. I mean, they're very competitive. You know, the few prizes that there are very, very competitive. And you know that you're going to have to play the best players, right? So I would say if you can, you know, focus more on improvement, recognizing that, hey, yeah, if I play up, I'm probably out of the money. You know, I'm probably, you know, going to a tournament and I'm not, you know, going to win a participation award or a small under prize or anything like that. But I am going to cut my teeth with the best players. And I did that regularly. And that helped me a lot. So I would say that's number one. So play better players for a variety of reasons. That's going to have a positive impact on your game, especially if you pay attention to what they're doing better than you. Number two, we talked about this before, the learner's mindset. As you become older, you're less willing to change things up, but changing things up is how you grow, and kind of exiting your comfort zone is often what needs to happen for you to grow. So I would just say that, you know, if you respect the person that's training you or you respect the people you're receiving advice from enough, you know, while uncomfortable, it's super important to keep your mind open to learning new things and stepping outside of your comfort zone.
Good stuff.
So that's number two. And number three is, we also discussed this briefly, is the element of hard work, which of course everyone knows, but I'll get a little bit more specific on that. As we discussed, to me, the hard work are those 10 to 15 minute puzzles that we talked about, where it's like, I'm really trying to solve something, but it's not coming to me immediately. And I have to dig deep and really fry my brain to get the answer right. I think pushing yourself to that limit is really a great way to improve. So when you're talking about hard work, not just work, I don't mean hard work like put in the hours, casually studying an opening book or casually studying or watching a video. I really mean the work that is a little uncomfortable, that really presses you, right? That really, it might even tire you out. You know, you do 3 or 4 puzzles like that, it might take an hour, and you're kind of fried after that. A similar feeling you may experience when you play a rated chess game. right? You play the rated chess game, you're trying your hardest, firing on all cylinders, and you finish your game and you're like, you know, I am exhausted, right? Like, I've calculated so much, I've considered so much, and trying to replicate that at home is not always easy, you know, in a casual setting. So I would say that that's very important. And of course, I have to say, like, just general chess study is also very good. Reading books on positional play, many of the books that you've discussed here on your podcast are fantastic. So I won't go through all of them again. And you know, it's nothing against those books. It's just that, as we've discussed, there's a knowledge element of the game. So simply knowing things like common ideas, patterns, etc. But then there's the actual coming up with the moves and coming up with the actual concrete lines of play to carry them out. And that is, for all levels, the most, I would say, difficult part of the game to get better at.
Yeah, great advice. And Peter, if I may be so bold as to throw in one more, one more bullet point from all of the knowledge that you've shared, what you've mentioned about studying with your buddy Dominique about, yes, like pairing up and working together, I do think that finding, especially when we're talking about the hard work, as you mentioned, finding a study partner can really keep you going. So I don't know if you'll accept that addendum, but I thought it was a really good point.
I totally do. And I definitely attribute finishing the Volokitin book, Perfect Your Chess, to my work with Dominique, because I'm not sure if I would have shown up every day to finish that book, you know, and because it was grueling. I feel like I'd probably work on a puzzle for like 3 to 5 minutes and then I'd be like, ah, screw it. And then I'd like, yeah, look at the answer. So no one would be holding me accountable. And so, yeah, study partner. And now with ease of technology and everything, it's like you don't even have to have a study partner that's like, okay, Dominique and I live in the same city, so we would meet up at a coffee shop. But you could meet somebody on Zoom just to hold each other accountable and say, hey, why don't we spend an hour together doing some challenging puzzles? And for me, it was Volokitin because I was 2100 at that time. But for others, it's a different tactics book. And I don't want to – I'm not trying to plug any books or anything. It's just I think we talked about this, but – basically a puzzle where you're going to be challenged for 10 to 15 minutes. I don't think you want to go beyond that. But I don't think you want to solve them too easily either. And I think that those not only help with tactical play, but it also just helps with visualizing the board and the calculation side of chess, which isn't always synonymous with tactics.
Yeah, that's a good distinction. Now, Peter, you said you don't want to plug books, but there is one book I'd like to plug. Have you heard of this book, Everyone's First Chess Workbook?
I heard of it, Ben. It isn't released yet, but I've gotten some sample pages of it. So I think I'll probably get it when it comes out.
Yeah, brand new from New in Chess, this author named FM Peter Giannatos. And yeah, we can stop playing around now. Peter sent me that book. And, you know, as regular listeners know, like Peter, I'm a former Scholastic teacher. And it's amazing. I mean, it's always exactly what I wanted. When I was teaching more Scholastic programs, my go-to books were the Laszlo Polgár Super Thick book. There's this old yellow book by Al Wollom. There's the Chess Steps books. And there's the Jeff Coakley books. And Peter, I put your book right there with those four. To me, it's like it's got a wide breadth of topics that it covers. I often talk about, I love the fact that there's defensive puzzles in there. So we should say for listeners, it's primarily, I think you said, Peter, for below 1,000, like real life rating, which is often like 1,300, say, Lee Chess Rapid rating. Is that right?
Yeah, that would be the target for this particular book. And one of the reasons we chose the name Everyone's First Chess Workbook as opposed to the Workbook for Children or something like that is it really is the fundamentals of board vision. So it's everything from checkmates in 1, 2 and themed patterns, like let's say the Anastasia's checkmate, and all the fundamental tactics you need to know. And then, so it is, but it is not something geared toward an adult or geared toward a child. It really just is the content you need at the fundamental level.
Yeah, and it is a workbook, as you point out, I believe, in the introduction. Like, you leave room for people to write in it. So, obviously, again, for players that level, it's great. But also, I know we have a lot of chess teachers listening, and you guys definitely need to add it to your rotation. Obviously, Peter's a friend of the show, but, I mean, you guys hearing him talk know that if he's going to put his name on something, he's going to put the work in. So, anything else that people should know about the book, Peter?
Yeah, so I would say from the educator's standpoint, one of the things I wanted to do as you mentioned, I wanted a traditional workbook. And in fact, when it came across, when the negotiations came across with New in Chess, they had never done a traditional workbook before where you have, like, let's say, lines to write answers in and formatted it in such a way. And the workbook is also workbook size. So it's not the size of a standard New in Chess book. It is a workbook size. So the size of, let's say, a sheet of paper. And so the diagrams are large. They're clearly visible. And there is a clear place to put your answer. And in the introduction, I talk a little bit about how writing down an answer is a second form of rehearsal. And that I think it's very useful for everyone to do that when you're solving. When you're doing chess puzzles. In addition, every chapter is broken down into a guided practice and test portion. So let's say it's the chapter on forks. The first, let's say, 9 puzzles have a guided hint. So it kind of says, hey, notice how the king and rook are an L shape away from each other, or something like that, right? And then the remaining problems in the chapter, a part of the test problems would be formatted the same, except no hints. And it's just to say, hey, like, when I feel like I've helped you enough, now you're on your own. And the book gets progressively harder, but I'm always there to kind of assist you with learning each theme and each topic.
Yeah. And we should say it's available on Chessable as well, right, Peter?
Definitely. And while in Chessable, you don't get the writing element, you still get the ability to actually move the pieces out. There are additional comments to each move because that's the nature of Chessable. Like, I can add comments to every move. And as you review it, you can see a comment basically for literally every move. Like, even the most trivial move has a comment. And there is a video option too. So if you'd rather, depending on the age, or, you know, for me, I wasn't, my reading comprehension isn't my best, attribute. You know, I get distracted very easily. So videos, are a little bit, I like to solve, but I don't like to read. So videos are usually better for me. And I know a lot of other people are like that, but of course the text is there as well, just like it is in the book. So yeah, depending on how people like to, depending on how people like to do things, there's a physical book produced by New in Chess, which will be out in early September. And the Chessable course is already live with the video option as well.
Yeah. And for all the chess moms and dads listening, the Chessable course could be a good thing to go through with your kid, especially if they're, again, if they're on the newer side to chess, if they're already fast tracked and playing open sections of nationals and stuff like that, then there's plenty of other books for them to get. But this is a great addition to the marketplace for newer players. So glad to see you take the time to do that, Peter, because I know you're a busy man. So the last topic, we got to bring the heat, Peter.
Yes.
So I, of course, I'm sure you did too, because I forgot to note the date, but I'm going to say it was 3 weeks to a month ago. The New York Times came out with an article by Ivan Nechepurenko and Misha Friedman. And the article is called The Dark Side of Chess, Payoffs, Points, and 12-Year-Old Grandmasters. And the article is about a number of things, but it was published not that long after Abhimanyu Mishra became the youngest grandmaster in the world. So it touched on that, and it touched on Sergei Karjakin, who was the prior youngest grandmaster in the world. Of course, this has been a landmark record that some of the giants in chess history have broken, such as Bobby Fischer and Judit Polgar preceding these individuals. And basically, it dug up some good dirt and had some solid reporting on certain parts, and then other parts we felt weren't as well reported. So, Peter, let's walk me through it. The day this article came out, how soon did you get a text message?
Right. Yeah. I because the Charlotte Chess Center Norm events were featured in a line or two of the article, because one in the United States, by far, we're the norm round robin capital here in Charlotte, and of course Abhimanyu had played in several of our norm events as well. So I'm sure they figured that out when they were digging into his tournament history. So even the slightest note about the Charlotte Chess Center gets people text messaging me, right? So I, check this article. You're in the New York Times. I say, oh my gosh, the New York Times. You know, that's big, right? That's exposure. And so I'm reading the article, and I just have to openly be honest about it. I'm disappointed with the way the article was written, because, like you said, it's called the dark side of chess. And you know, I was thinking maybe I should write a counter article called the dark side of journalism. But right. No, it's the dark side of chess, payoffs, points, and 12-year-old grandmasters. So the title is fine if you're gonna kind of stick to the Karjakin story, because it seems that I had heard about the Karjakin situation.
We should say, I think a lot of people will have read the article. The date was July 16th, 2021, by the way. July 13th. And of course, we'll link to the article. And anyone listening, if you're like super fastidious, you can pause it, read the article, and come back. But we should say explicitly what the Karjakin allegations are.
Right. So Karjakin, who prior to Abhimanyu, as you mentioned, was the world's youngest grandmaster ever. And according to some evidence and also hearsay, because I heard about this as I was playing chess too. Like this, before this article came out, I was already kind of aware. But of course, I never dug into it or had interest to, because of course, Karjakin is a former world championship contender. And I think he's kind of he has a fantastic chess career to stand behind. So whether he was the youngest grandmaster or not, it doesn't, to me, it's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. It appears that maybe his father had arranged for certain results so that he could get that final grandmaster norm and become the world champion or the youngest grandmaster in the world. And it appears that there was, let's say, some game fixing in that particular round robin tournament where Karjakin earned his final norm.
Yeah. I cut and pasted a few quotes to share with you guys. One is, it's an open secret in chess that many players cut side deals with tournament organizers and other top competitors that help them achieve norms that they might have struggled to get legitimately. And then, as Peter says, they specifically, to my mind, found possibly some new reporting on Karjakin having replayed a game and replayed it in blitz in order to get his final GM norm after having lost it in classical. But then they go on to make it, as Peter said, his reputation and all that he's achieved stands for itself. And they kind of make it seem like everything that he subsequently achieved was a direct result of winning that title. Now, of course, it does put the wind at your back. You know, you may get a few more invitations and stuff like that, but I mean, any serious chess player knows that the quality of your moves is what determines the outcome of your games over a wide sample. He's not buying every single game. So that was a minor quibble. But then, as Peter says, the Abhimanyu story is where it gets even bigger. And Peter, I'll toss it back over to you in one sec. But one other thing I just wanted to throw in, because since you mentioned the title, which is rather salacious, but we do, of course, want to mention that often writers for periodicals don't write the title. So we're not necessarily castigating the writers for that particular thing. But as for Abhimanyu, I felt it was quite unfair, Peter, and you could speak more about why I know you're even more qualified to address this.
Well, that was the part that bothered me about the article, because if you're sharing facts about something that happened, then that's great. You know, that's what we need to hear the facts, right? We always want to know what the reality is and what the truth is about something. So if they did some investigative journalism, I know that they talked to or have some quotes from the grandmaster who Karjakin had played. And so I should say that while maybe that's a bit of an unethical reflection on Karjakin's father, and that, of course, we shouldn't have situations like that occur, it's nothing against Karjakin because he was a child. He was a child at that time. And it doesn't give the concept of match fixing a pass. But I should just say that it's not really a reflection upon Karjakin either. So I should say that. The part I didn't like is not that you're exposing the truth. The part I didn't like was running the parallel between that circumstance and how Abhimanyu achieved his norms. Because by running the stories alongside one another in the same article, where you make really the article isn't about the youngest grandmaster achievement, but it's more about, I mean, literally the title is about like shady acts in chess, and the whole article is about that. I felt also, like you did, that it was unfair to Abhimanyu because there's no evidence to suggest that any match fixing or any rules were broken for Abhimanyu, when Abhimanyu achieved his necessary norms and rating, by the way.
Yeah.
I have to tell people that when you're getting your grandmaster title approved, you have to have a 2500 FIDE rating. It can be a live rating, something that you once hit and went below. So it can be a peak 2500 FIDE rating. And these three, let's say, norms. You should probably Google exactly what a norm is, but it's a level of performance in a particular high level event.
Yeah, well said. And a couple other points worth highlighting, as I think you messaged me when we were corresponding. They mention kind of again, sort of salaciously, the Abhimanyu Mishra in the tournaments where he ultimately did earn the norms in Budapest, which is well-known place, even grander history than Charlotte, of people going there to play small invitational tournaments, hoping to earn norms. And they noted that the average rating in these tournaments in Budapest was lower than Peter's tournaments that Abhimanyu also has played in Charlotte. But why is that not relevant, Peter?
Yeah, well, it's not relevant because in people's minds, it's relevant, but norms are based on performance rating. So if the average field is a lower rated, the norm me, if you will, has to score a higher score, right? Because if the average rating is lower, they have to perform at a much higher level. So at our events, we try to keep norms for grandmasters at 6.5 points out of 9. But if you lower the rating average, players may have to score 7 out of 9 or 7.5 out of 9 or 8 out of 9 and so on and so on. And everyone knows that when you're playing masters of any kind, that type of score is so difficult to achieve. So it is a rating calculation, a performance rating calculation. So dare I say, if you have a section full of washed up GMs, like everyone likes to call, to say, like 2400 rated GMs, that's not going to cut it, because the other 7 players in the field are going to have to make up for some of that lost rating. And I don't want to confuse people with how it all works, because I realize I've been in this sphere for a very long time. I mean, about norms and constructing norm events and how they kind of work. But if the rating average of the field is lower, the player has to perform still at the same level, which means they would have to score more points in the event.
Yeah. So it's basically a moot point. Now, they also sort of suggest that these tournaments, as I recall, there was more innuendo about the tournaments in Budapest in terms of like a lot of the regular participants being, I guess, to put it charitably, not motivated. And to put it less charitably, perhaps, again, some sort of bribery or game fixing involved at times.
Right.
And again, with Karjakin, to their credit, they kind of found a smoking gun, it seemed. I mean, they had people on the record, but that was kind of the only case. And then they made these kind of broad extrapolations, which again, like, okay, you know, it's a bit unfair to Chess, but more importantly, this is a kid we're talking about who just achieved an amazing thing, you know, just an incredible accomplishment. So yeah, a bit frustrating, and I'm sure frustrating for his family to be cast in that light.
Absolutely. And, you know, I can say that, you know, I've played Abhimanyu in rated classical tournament games before he was such a monster. And so I've known his father in passing for a while. And I've known Abhimanyu since he was like seven when we played. You know, he was the youngest expert or something like that when he's seven or eight. And then, you know, at some point was eligible to participate in our Norm tournaments here in Charlotte and participated. And I can say that there has, you know, never, there was never any ethical or moral kind of things in question when dealing with Abhimanyu's father. There was never a like, oh, you know, hey, you know, he just needs to kind of draw this game to secure a norm or anything like that. Can you talk to the player? No, first of all, we don't do that. But second of all, it was never even in the discussion. And so what, and I never even got that from him, you know, personality wise and stuff like that. So why I didn't like the article is here we have an American born child achieving a fantastic, it's a fantastic achievement, the youngest grandmaster in the world. And I see his story being run alongside a story of one that's shady. And I just don't like it because there's no evidence to suggest that a similar thing was done just because Abhimanyu participated in Norm tournaments. And even though the article, I guess the article showed the Charlotte Chess Center in a more positive light, let's say, than the Budapest tournament, still, I didn't like that they ran the parallel there because there's no evidence to suggest that anything like that took place at the tournament. Now, to the point of unmotivated players playing in the tournament, like let's say grandmasters who are lower rated grandmasters, maybe they're not as motivated to, or able to play at their peak rating anymore. Remember that as their rating goes down from these events, right? If they're not as motivated, if they cannot play as well as they once could, that difference in rating needs to be made up elsewhere. And it's not just as simple as saying you got to have three GMs and then the rest of the field can be whatever. Right. You have to have a certain, like as mentioned, certain rating averages so that you can have certain performance rating needed for the Grandmaster Norm achievement. So the point of match fixing, I've seen it in my lifetime where even at open tournaments in the final round, players will agree to drawing a game or throwing a game to secure a prize fund. That could certainly happen for a Norm achievement as well at a tournament, at even an open tournament. So I feel like in these round robins, FIDE and the players and organizers, you know, FIDE has to trust their organizers. They have to trust us enough to say, we're not going to allow a bribe to take place in our tournament, right? You're not going to come to me, Ben, and say, I want to play your IM tournament. I'll give you $1,000 if you can negotiate with the IMs to throw their games so I can get my, that's not going to happen here in Charlotte. And I don't know what happens everywhere else, but there's no evidence to suggest that it happened in Budapest. And so that's why I didn't like the way the article was written. If there was evidence to suggest that something like that had taken place, then sure, then show me the money.
Yeah.
But I just didn't see that, and it bothered me because here we have a kid, right? They're shaming a kid for achieving something so great, and they're just running a parallel between something that Karjakin did a couple decades ago.
Yeah, well said. And for the record, I mean, Peter and I, I'm sure, we both know a lot of people who the people who know the chess world well who reacted the same way. And that's not to say that the norm system is perfect by any means. And as Peter said, like everyone who's been around chess for a long time has heard stories of match fixing. So it's not to say that everything's perfect, but to cast aspersions in this particular case and to, you know, use someone's name without evidence was not a great look, in my opinion. And yeah, you just feel bad for the kid. And Peter, I wanted to zoom out a little bit because it also gets to the larger topic of sort of if grandmaster titles are being diluted, depending on if you trust the New York Times fact checkers or the New Yorker fact checkers. There's between 1700 to 1900 grandmasters in the world these days. There have been different reports. And of course, world champion finalist Jan Nepomniachtchi, a couple days after Abhimanyu won the title, actually took to Twitter and said, "I'm dazzled with the new record, so I'd like to suggest some changes to the order of conferring titles. For example, one of the norms, Grandmaster norms, must be fulfilled in an open tournament, and the participation of 2,400 GM luminaries in stamping new titles should finally be limited." So, and in that same New York Times article, they had Nigel Short, who, by the way, of course, affiliated with FIDE, saying like they should just get rid of Grandmaster titles. So it all seemed like a very sort of sharp reaction to this what's been a sort of slowly growing in the discourse theme of the Grandmaster title being diluted. What do you think about that, independent of the Abhimanyu allegations, Peter?
So I don't know. Like in my life, I have met and played what people would consider weak GMs, and I can assure you that somebody as strong as Nepo could say this person's a weak GM. But for me, I don't find any GM to be weak. And despite the fact that maybe, let's say, their rating has dropped from where it was 20 years ago, that's where I would actually say, Ben, and I don't want to go off on a tangent too much here, is you get that balance between knowledge and the application of the knowledge with concrete moves. I feel like the older players, that's where they're unable to kind of hang with the younger GMs. So like in our tournaments and stuff, we see that a lot of times. You know, if we have, let's say, a 2450 rated GM playing a young 2500 GM, we see that the game goes pretty fine in the opening and middle game, but maybe the older player gets a little tired later on in the game, or maybe their calculation isn't as good as it once was. But a GM is still a GM, and I applaud them for continuing to play, even though they know they're not at the level they once were. And I'm not one of those people. As we discussed, I believe that I would not perform as well as I could when I was trying my hardest. So I choose not to play. Mm-hmm. But I applaud them for playing. So as far as there being more GMs and whether or not we should, the GM title is being diluted, I don't think it is. I think that players are becoming more knowledgeable. Players are becoming better on a larger scale. The resources are there for people to become better. So as a consequence, we see more GMs being created. Now, I do think, I wouldn't be opposed to, let's say, a super GM title, because there's already kind of an unofficial super GM title that we regularly use in conversation. Like, you know, Nepo, for example, is what we would consider a super GM, though that's not a actual FIDE title. So something could be said about maybe even a bar higher for the very best.
Yeah, I agree. And just to add a few more points, I mean, number one, so whatever the number is, 1700 to 1900, if you think of Grandmaster as like a rough proxy for being like a professional chess player, which of course we know that in terms of people making their income from actually playing chess, it's going to be a much smaller number. But still, if you compare it to other like sports, for lack of a better comparison, I mean, there's something like 500 players in the NBA, and then you have all the other leagues across the globe. You know, soccer/football, there's got to be like well more than 2,000 professional soccer players. So if you just compare it on that footing, I don't think it's like an out of bounds number. Now, of course, legends like Nigel Short and Jan Nepomniachtchi, they've seen the number explode in their lives. Like, I mean, in the 1980s, it was like 100 or something, you know, so it has grown exponentially. I see where they're coming from. And I'm also not opposed to something like a Super GM title, although I have seen some people do seem to be opposed to it. And yeah, I don't feel that strongly about it. But the bottom line is, it is a valid question, you know, sort of independent of the norm fixing. And the other valid question, Peter, we're going long, but I mean, we just haven't had a chance, and you're the perfect person to address this, is whether norms themselves need to be a thing. In my mind, it might just be that holding a rating for a certain number of games might be a better way to grant titles, because it kind of eliminates the unnecessary expense of traveling. I mean, this could cut into your bottom line of traveling to certain tournaments, and also may make it harder for any impropriety in terms of norm buying. What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, so I should actually say that one of the reasons why norm tournaments are a thing is because, you know, the norm criteria is sometimes very hard to achieve in the open tournament circuit. So for example, yeah. You know this very well. Just in the last, in my chess life, which has been a little over 15 years, I have seen, we're very fortunate in the United States to have universities that have chess programs and growing chess programs, right? So we've got, I won't label them all, but we have universities in the United States who, like athletic programs, recruit grandmasters and top players from all over the world to come to American universities and play chess on scholarship. And we're very lucky to have those players in the United States, because what those players bring along with them is their foreign FIDE federation, which is so important when one is trying to achieve a norm. And prior to those foreign players, when top grandmasters would leave their country of origin, wherever it was, like my coach, Grandmaster Alexander Shabalov, they switched to the United States Federation, their FIDE Federation, because it granted them more opportunities to play in, let's say, the U.S. Championship, which was still better than, let's say, the Latvian Championship or whatever. So even the foreign players who then relocated to the United States didn't always bring their FIDE title. So we have this huge country of in the United States, but not a lot of foreign players. So prior to Charlotte, most people were going to Budapest. I mean, I knew a lot of American players, almost every American player, including my good friend Daniel Naroditsky, who earned a Grandmaster norm in Budapest. Almost every American-born titled player had at least played once in Budapest in a norm tournament. And that's not because there aren't strong players in the U.S. They're trying to meet that foreign player criteria that's necessary to score a norm. For example, there's a player who's playing our next norm tournament over Labor Day, Nicholas Theodorou. He's an international master rated 2570 FIDE, and he's an IM still. He wins every American Open tournament and never gets a norm, even if it's nine rounds, because he doesn't play enough. He doesn't play enough foreign rated players. In fact, he played a tournament in Greece recently, his country of origin. He's a student at not Mizzou, not Webster, St. Louis University.
Yeah.
He played a large open tournament in Greece, killed it. Great tournament. Didn't get a norm because didn't play enough. So he can't. He's struggling to get it in the U.S. because even though American players carry a foreign federation, you still need three different federations represented. So they can't all be American players. And so part of the reason these norm tournaments exist is because of this very strict, like, location-based criteria that FIDE has for norms. Like, you have to play foreign players. And so if it wasn't for that, then I believe that the need for norm tournaments would actually go down quite a bit. I mean, there's still an argument to be made about playing a pool of players that's similarly rated, which you wouldn't be guaranteed in an open tournament. You could go from playing in a 2500 to a 1900. You know what I mean? And there's some rating instability there. But it's really the norm tournament business, if you will, is mainly based on this element of this criteria where players are required to play players from different federations to achieve their norms. And so as far as changing the criteria, I don't know, you know, like think about it. I mean, if you're an American player, are you forced to travel to Europe so that you can play enough foreigners, or is it okay that you can play a norm tournament in Charlotte in you know, domestically, and you know, a tournament is formed with a correct criteria, you just have to perform like a grandmaster.
Yeah.
A very strong grandmaster, I should say, to get a norm.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's still, I think, just forget the norms. Just achieve 2,500 FIDE, stay over it for 50 games or whatever it may be, and you're a grandmaster, you know?
Right. And yeah, and I haven't, to be honest, I haven't even thought about it. What I'm good at is I read the rules, right?
Yeah.
I look at the rules and I say, this is what needs to happen for players. This is what, you know, these are the rules that they have in place. Now, you know, Nigel Short, and I don't know Nigel personally, but I respect him as a chess player, but he's in FIDE.
Yeah.
So what's he telling, like, exactly. What's he talking about? Like, yeah. it's like he's crapping on the system, which really those within FIDE need to adjust if they want to adjust. Blaming organizers or blaming players for creating events that follow the rules developed by the institution is kind of silly to me, to be honest with you, Ben, because it's like we're just following the rules and the players are just following the rules. Listen, you want an achievement, right? So you just want to achieve what you want to achieve, and you'll do it legally, right? You'll do it without breaking the rules, without some sort of, you know, without breaking the sort of ethical code. But, you know, however the rules adapt, everyone will adapt and follow, right? If you have a 50-game rule, for example, like hold your rating at 2,500 for 50 games. So then you have unethical situations where I organize a tournament where everyone's 2,500 FIDE and everyone just draws the hell out of their games
right.
And then keeps their 2,500 rating. So no matter what system you have, there will always be, you know, something formed so that players can legally obtain what they're set out to obtain. And that's just like the real world, you know, not just chess.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. There's no panacea for sure. Okay, last thing, Peter, I do have to ask you the hard-hitting question. So you mentioned, of course, that you obviously wouldn't do anything improper as the organizer of the Charlotte chess tournaments. And you know, I have zero doubt about that. But have you ever been offered any sort of bribe to you know, put your thumb on the scale somehow in one of the norm events that you guys have run?
No, and I think the reason for that, and I should say that there have been norm tournaments where no one has achieved the norm. There have been norm, we've run 22 norm tournaments. There have been tournaments where no one's achieved a norm. There have been tournaments where a draw in the final round secures a norm and the player did not get the draw.
Yeah.
There have been tournaments with John Bartholomew, for example, just to hit close to home for people listening, who needed a victory in the last round and didn't get it and lost out on a norm. He half a point wouldn't do it. He needed a win. Right. And so, you know, there are plenty. We broadcast the games live. The standings are live. We post pictures. You can come to the chess center if you want, if you're really that interested, the New York Times can come on down to the chess center and we'll happily give them a press pass to hang around if they'd like. We're public about it. We're open about it. And I think people know, see, the reputation that the Chess Center has is bigger than just the norm tournaments. We have scholastic programming, a local program. I am not going to risk that for a $500 bribe or whatever it may be. So people don't even ask, even if they're thinking it. And I don't even think at most people's heart, they want to earn it that way, to be honest, Ben. I don't know about you, but I wouldn't personally want to earn such a thing illegitimately, because I'd have to live the rest of my life knowing that I'm a piece of garbage for doing it and that I didn't actually achieve it. Right. So I don't want to live my life like that. And I don't think most people do. But I think people recognize that the Chess Center is bigger than just these norm tournaments, and that they wouldn't basically even dare ask me because they know that I would just go crazy. So no one has ever asked me. I'm very fortunate because that would be a very awkward situation, and I don't know how I would. I know I wouldn't accept it. I just don't know beyond that how I would.
Yeah.
How I would handle it. You know, whether I would submit an ethics complaint, for example, because we've never had a situation like that, and we keep it that way. So as far as our norm tournaments go, I'm happy for anyone to investigate our events, talk to people who play in our events, look at the results, come on down to the Chess Center. We have another norm event over Labor Day. Come on down to the Chess Center, see what they're like, experience it for themselves. But they're totally legitimate tournaments. And yes, just like in an open event, will there be some quick draws and stuff? Yes, but they're not orchestrated. They're not orchestrated draws. We don't control the players, nor do we attempt to control them. If they agree to a draw, that's on them. Yeah. And remember that in our norm events, you need a +4 score for a norm. And so a draw is not going to get you there. You know what I mean? Everyone is very similarly rated. So whether you draw the 2480 GM and then in the next round, you got to play a 2480 IM that's hungry and been studying and has 800 coaches, you can roll the dice on that one, right? So a quick draw here and there that happens in the open tournament circuit, that happens in our norm tournaments, we don't necessarily like it. It doesn't provide good content for the viewers, but strategy on who you'd like to draw, who you'd like to try to beat, that strategy, Ben, it's competitive strategy, right? You're playing in an event and you're like, okay, I'm looking at this 10-man field. Who are the four whipping boys, right? Who am I going after to try to win these games? And that's strategy. And so if you get to the game and you think drawing a player is your best result, right? Is the best thing for your event, right? You believe that drawing is your best way to your norm? That's on you. That's your strategy. Maybe you're wrong. Maybe you need that extra half a point in the end. You don't know. You don't know how the tournament's going to go. So I don't know what to say, Ben. The reason why I angrily texted you when the article came out and I'm like, get me on this show is because I didn't like how it made it seem. And actually, it wasn't just the article, but me reading the comments, which is probably a mistake.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's a good gauge because it's not going to be all super informed, you know, people.
Right.
So,
yeah. And me reading the comments, it's kind of like, whoa, everyone slow down. So norm tournaments can be totally legitimate tournaments. And as far as I'm aware I've never been a part of a norm tournament. I've played two norm tournaments as a player, not my own. Played one in St. Louis and one in Montreal as a player. I am norm tournament. In fact, one of the players he needed to draw me or beat me to keep his norm chance alive, and I beat him. There was never ever a discussion about, can you just let me off the hook with here or whatever? I'm like, I'm there to play too.
Yeah.
Right. I've played in norm tournaments. We've organized over 20 of them. We've organized plenty of open 9-round tournaments for norms. I've never had a bribe. I've never had come to me with a bribe. I've never heard of one being offered to a player around us, right? Because it could, like, for example, if you and I are destined to play, I could just come straight to you and say, hey, Ben, can you give me the game for $500? I've never experienced that in one of these events. So the parallels that were drawn, I thought were misleading, and that's why I wanted to get on the show. If Nigel Short, even the FIDE president mentioned that there was some things they didn't like about the norm events, change it.
Yeah, change the rules.
Change it.
Yeah,
because we are going to look at the FIDE rules. We're going to organize our tournaments on the FIDE rules, and we're not going to break the rules. And if the FIDE rules adjust, we will adjust. And so will everyone else be forced to. So if they're listening, and they don't find the system to be the way they'd like it, they are the ones in power. They have the ability to push that change. We're kind of little guys in the large scheme of things. We run the events, but we have no political power, no political influence to change anything. So that is what it is.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm glad that you cleared that up. I think you did a great job. I mean, again, there it's not no one's saying that the system is perfect necessarily, but definitely the article was a bit unfair in some places, and some of the nature in which complaints about the system are being lodged seem a bit unfair. But Peter, it's been great as always. So we should wrap up. The book is called
Everyone's First Chess Workbook.
Thank you. I apologize. It's getting late here. The book is called Everyone's First Chess Workbook, available on Chessable, available in paperback. You can check out a free preview on New in Chess's website. Well, it might not be available in paperback the moment you listen, but coming very soon. So Peter, been great as always. Thank you for sharing your chess improvement tips and your norm knowledge and all the rest.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ben, for having me on. I'd like to say in regard to the book, I just did a book tour signing down in Jacksonville, Florida for the Chess for Charity group down there. They're doing great things. There are partners, let's say, in the Southeast, along with Grandmaster Ben Feingold and his club in Atlanta. And we're really trying to do big things for chess in the U.S. and really build chess in the Southeast, which is a kind of region that hasn't really flourished as much as other places. So I wanted to give them a shout out and kind of our partners in helping us grow chess. And we work closely with them. And so more than the norm tournaments and more than my book and more than just general chess improvement, we're working on growing the game in our region. So
that's awesome. Yeah. And if anyone wants Peter's advice or wants to do a similar event, not hard to find, right? Peter, you're on, obviously there's the Charlotte Chess Center website. Is there any other way people should look to reach you?
For me, my email is public on the Charlotte Chess Center website. And I have a Facebook, but I try to keep it with people that, I actually know. But anyone can feel free to email me. And then the Chess Center itself has Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and we're relatively active on there with, posts, especially during our norm events. We have a lot, who's achieving the norms, who's still in contention, and all the other events that we do here at the club. So yeah, definitely can follow the Charlotte Chess Center on social media. Feel free to email me directly at my direct email address, which is on the Charlotte Chess Center website openly. I hope everyone likes what we're doing here in Charlotte. And then for those who are able to obtain the book or the Chessable course, I hope you enjoy that as well. And I hope that that's a good addition to the educational tools in chess.
Yeah, it definitely is. All right. Thank you again, Peter. It's been a lot of insight and much appreciated.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible, most of all to my producer, Matthew Passy. I also would like to thank everyone who helped spread the word about the show. Did you guys know that there's still people who have not heard of the Perpetual Chess podcast? There's even chess players who have not heard of the Perpetual Chess podcast. So we need to fix that. And the ways to do that include writing positive reviews on podcast platforms or YouTube comments, telling friends, all that stuff makes a difference in helping spread the word about the show. But of course, I most of all want to thank people who provide financial support to the show. Without you all, Perpetual Chess would not be possible. So without further ado, I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com, coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, Apprentice Twitch Channel, Aniti Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Heath, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Snyder, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Farhan Thawar, Barasawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, I am Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, James Holyhead, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Cell, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdinaze Twitch channel, Grandmaster Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodi, Philip Flemons, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, Ross Crossland, Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Steven Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patsers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Bean, William Hogarth, and I also would like to thank Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio K. Leonfort, FM Andre Terakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard, Lynn, Brian, Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Chad Hilton, Chess Patser Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wayne Scott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Blaskoczek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley, Dalen Shelton, Tennis Parrish, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Melo Paria, Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Francis Letart Lavoir, Dr. Frank Tortoris, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Perry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse Dacumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almagar, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, WGM Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, I am Kostya Kubutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Ryforth, Laura Boyovsky, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emelyanovas, aka PhotoChess, Mark Shaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovic, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Gobel, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Negma Malajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Blaine, Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited of Switzerland, Randall Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel and publishing empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwalder, Sergey McCagan, Seth Ruzica, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatev Abrahamian, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks to you all for the support, and we will catch you all next week.
Sports Social Podcast Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.